Dr. Ken Boa is the president of Reflections Ministries and Trinity House Publishers. He continues today with part three of his talk on Understanding Islam, with a look at Sharia law and the Quran. Here with our study is our teacher, Dr. Ken Boa.
We've explored thus far five of the pillars of Islam, but here I now say that there's a possible sixth, and many suppose that a sixth pillar, in addition to the five basics, need to be added. The five basics we saw were the testimony, where they, on several times a day, will say a particular sentence in Arabic that affirms that there is no God but Allah and Muhammad is his prophet, is what it translates to mean. And they'll do this regularly, every day of their lives. And the prayer is also very, very straightforward and simple. One of the things I mentioned last time is that the idea of the requirements of what does it take to be a Muslim? Tell me what it takes. I can outline it in 5 minutes. In fact, I'm being generous when I say 5 minutes, because you basically pray five times a day. Now, it would take you a little while to learn the procedures of the prayer, but once you've memorized that, it's a choreography. It's unvarying. The prayer never changes. The motions, the movements are choreographed. It is not a relationship. It is a ritual act of submission to the will of Allah. It's not a relationship. And so, therefore, once you've memorized it, and it's done in Arabic, and so many of the people don't even know what the words mean, but they have to memorize it by the syllables. You see the concept? But you do that five times a day, and that's pretty clearly prescribed. And the third thing that we talked about was almsgiving, which is 2.5% of one's income that's given. And then the fourth one we mentioned was the fast of, often it's called the month of Ramadan, and it's a lunar calendar, so that moves a little bit. But basically, during that 1 month, the fast takes place between sunrise and sunset, which means you can eat whatever you want after the sun goes down. And I mentioned last time, it's kind of ironic that actually more food is consumed during that month of Ramadan than any other month. But that's, you know, people get hungry, I guess, and then they pack it away after the sun goes down. But then the fifth one is the idea of pilgrimage. And pilgrimage is this Hajj, and it's when you go up to Mecca, and every able-bodied Muslim is supposed to try to go there at least once in their lifetime to go around certain rituals that are associated with the mosque there, but also the Kaaba, the special white stone. It's just like this, almost this large cubicle that contains this white, black stone that's there. And there are certain procedures that are associated with that, where one goes seven times around that, and then one also runs between these two hills, and that symbolizes the flight of Hagar. And then you also do a 13-mile walk, and certain ritual procedures that are done, but that's not required more than one time. Some will do it more than once, but it's that's a commitment in a lifetime for every able-bodied Muslim. But many Muslims believe that Islam also contains a sixth pillar, and that would be holy war or jihad. And remember what we said that jihad means. The word literally means struggle. That's what it means, the idea of struggle. And indeed, one Islamic hadith. Now, the hadith are sayings of Muhammad that were written many years after his death. Many years. These are traditions and sayings. And one of those describes jihad in the hadith as second only to belief in God. So there are some who take this very, very seriously indeed. It's the belief that Muslims should engage in a holy struggle to preserve Islam against non-Muslim beliefs. And while Orthodox Muslims consider jihad to be a literal, even military struggle against unbelievers, some of the ones who are more liberal scholars interpret it as a spiritual or internal struggle. So you're going to have a difference of how literally do we take this? Is it actually warfare, or is it just a spiritual thing? However, the wording of the Quran, as well as the militant life of Muhammad that we've described already, and as well the history of Islamic conquest, all these would, I think, favor an emphasis on a more literal understanding of jihad as a literal struggle with those who are outside the land of and the world of Islam. And so that provides a way of understanding that pillar in a different light. So effectively, martyrdom, interestingly enough, is the only Islamic promise that provides eternal security. It's a religion, basically, in which there is never any certitude about one's eternal destiny, because you never can be sure whether your good works outweighed your bad or whether you've attained favor enough to enter into paradise rather than going into the flames of hell. And so you have no assurance of security. This is why you can imagine, then, if there is one little way of getting that security, namely death in through martyrdom, that would be an attractive thing if a person takes all this quite seriously. And the Hadith, chapter 1, verse 35, puts it this way. Again, these are the sayings of Muhammad that were written years later, but they're regarded as a holy book. The person who participates in jihad, or holy battles, in Allah's cause will be admitted to paradise if he is killed in the battle as a martyr. In other words, if it's a result of jihad, of struggle in that warfare, then there is this promise that one could then attain eternal life. And there are other hadiths that describe what that might be associated with. And we've all heard about the 72 virgins and so forth. And there's actually some misconstruals concerning that, which I won't go into, though it's not quite as simple as that. At any rate, going back to where we've been, we've already talked about mystery. And recall what I meant by mystery, for those of you who weren't with us before, is the mystery. How is it possible for some people to adamantly argue that Islam is a religion of peace, whereas others will argue that it's a militant religion? And I gave various reasons why that mystery is there and why there is that confusion. And I described the fact that it's not a monolithic religion. There's a wide range of views that as well. The minority, it's only the minority of Muslims who take it in a, what I call a consistent manner, rather than being more moderate or just secular. And they take the Quran more seriously and literally. And then there's also, we mentioned, and I'll mention again tonight, the principle of abrogation, wherein the later, more militant verses of the Quran, which came from the time up in Medina, were the verses that trump the earlier verses, because the Quran itself teaches that the later verses should be taken if there's any conflict over the early verses. And we know that those later verses were more militant than peaceful. And then there was also this idea of taqiyya, which is a way in which one can actually be warranted to lie, to dissimulate in the name of holy war, so that you can say exactly what you do not mean. You can lie, basically, but it's not a lie because it's done in jihad. So that can also cause a lot of confusions. Hence, we hear a lot of religious leaders in Islam, especially when they know they're going to be heard in the media. In English, they may say something that sounds peaceful, but in their own context, and usually in Arabic, they'll say something that's radically contradictory. But they don't see this as actually a problem, because of that principle that allows that to occur. We've then explored a bit about the history, not only of Muhammad himself, but then of its spread, its dissemination, and then its movement into more of a period of dormancy after tremendous actual expansion and conquest, especially with the demise of the Ottoman Empire, during the First World War, and how it's only been in the last few decades that, as a result of wealth through oil, has actually now acquired a stronger position than it had before. So there was a couple of centuries of relative dormancy, but now it's beginning to come back in that respect, and it's spreading rapidly in that respect. We talked about the five pillars already of Islam. And what I want to do now, as I explore the basics, is to define certain terms that I think it might be helpful. So before we take a look at the Quran itself, I'd like to define a few helpful terms. The fact is that we want to speak about major sects. And when we speak about the major sects, as we observed before, we're looking at actually the Sunni, the Shia, the Sufi, as well as two other groups that are hardly known at all, the Karjite and the Kalam. But of those five, it's these first three, and particularly the Sunni and the Shia that you'll hear about. The Sunnis really are a distant third. But these are the basic major sects that I wanted to just to say a little bit about it. And I said that Islam is not monolithic. It's divided into these sects. And the two major sects of Islam, which represent over 90%, about 90% or more of Muslims, are the Sunni and the Shia. And Sunni means customs, effectively. It means customs referring to Muhammad. Whereas Shia translates to faction of Ali. And the Sunni, who are also known as the Sunnites, represent over 80% of all Muslims. And they believe that the successor of Muhammad, since he had no son, should be an elected successor. So that's when they came up with these four caliphs, or successors, who proceeded after that period of time. And they regarded it as elected successors, whereas the Shia, on the other hand, argued that Muhammad's successor should be a blood relative. So they begin with Ali, who was a cousin, and who was also the fourth of the caliphs. And so there's this difference of views, and it should then be a descendant of a blood relative. And the Sunnites saw the need for religious and political separation more than did the Shia, who felt instead that a more theocratic arrangement is needful. And so theocracy was seen as the best option of the Shia to rule and to live, and laws in that context would be determined largely by the Quran and by the Hadith, which are the teachings from which ethics and criminal law would then follow. And in opposition to the Sunnites, early Shia believed that the leader must be, as I said, a bloodline descendant of Muhammad, and that Muhammad had at this particular pool of Ghadir al-Khum explicitly designated Ali as his successor. And the Shia developed a theology around this. And their theology negated the caliphs and instead spoke about the idea of imams, and that the imam would be divinely chosen at birth. It's their own leaders, and those particular leaders who were divinely chosen at birth were also regarded as direct descendants of Muhammad's cousin Ali. And so the Shia teach as well that that the 12th generation, known as the 12th imam of that line, didn't die, but that he was taken by Allah to heaven or is hiding on the earth. And so the Mahdiites, of which the president of Iran is one, believe that it's the 12th imam who shall return to earth to be the Mahdi, or a messianic figure. And some actually believe that it'll require, in a kind of apocalyptic context, in order to bring that about. The idea then of some kind of an awful experience, awful thing, even the possibility of nuclear warfare, would be needful to bring the conditions whereby the Mahdi, the 12th Imam, would come. That changes the rules, as you can well imagine, concerning thermonuclear warfare, in terms of it no longer being really a deterrent, but rather something that, although many millions might die, ultimately the whole world would be brought under that messianic figure. Now, as this time cover story entitled Sunnis versus Shiites describes, why they hate each other, it reveals that these two major Islamic factions then are clearly at great odds with one another. And indeed, of the total Muslim population, roughly 10 to 13% are Shia, and 85 per approximately, maybe up to from maybe up as high as 90, but around 85% are Sunni, and that the Shias, the minorities, are located primarily in Iran, with a smattering in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia. There's a small number in those others, but primarily in Iran. And then I mentioned as well that there was a third sect, much smaller than these two, that some people know about. And these are called the Sufis, who are in fact Islamic mystics, like this whirling dervish. How many of you have heard of the whirling dervishes? That's the only thing they're known for is these dances that they do. And I saw a couple of them on the boat in the Nile cruise in Egypt, and it was interesting. I took a video of one of them. It was actually quite fascinating, I have to tell you. The guy went on for about 15 minutes, and it's a wonder that the man doing hundreds of turns in the same direction wouldn't fall over, but they have certain techniques that they use. But it was quite elaborate and very, very complex dance. And what's involved in that complex dance is the idea that if you, through meditation and through certain experiences, music and dance become a direct route to Allah through a mystical experience. What happened then is this. It was a response, really, in this smaller group to a perceived legalism within Islam. And they regarded the observance of religious law as mere outer conformity. So they wanted a desire for more of a personal experience with Allah through meditation and through an inner way of knowing Allah. But you have to bear in mind something, that it's actually an overcorrection of the ultimate transcendence of Allah. You see, I've mentioned before that Allah cannot be known in his person in a relational way at all. And this is almost an overreaction, where they went to the other extreme and made him so imminent that it borders on pantheism. So you can see, people have a habit of going one extreme or another. It's almost pantheistic union is what's going on through the mystical experience evoked by the music and by the movement of the dance. And so that's why that's such an important dimension. So in contrast to Orthodox Islam's firm belief in the absolute transcendence of God, in Sufism, as they put it, God is in all things and all things are in him, and their beliefs include then this kind of self, almost a form of self-deification, which are heretical to Orthodox Islam. So you can see why that would be problematic then in light of other, especially the Shia and the Sunni, would regard this as a problematic group. Now, having said that, I want to also move into what are the holy books of Islam? We've all heard of the Quran, but let's explore these. The Quran is indeed the highest authority, having allegedly been transmitted from Muhammad, from Allah through the angel Gabriel, and that secondary to the Quran are what I've already alluded to in our time together, the Hadith, which are known as the sayings of Muhammad, and also what are called the Sunnah, which are his works or his examples. And the Hadith and the Sunnah effectively operate as instruction to the Muslim in much way as the Talmud and the Midrash expands the Hebrew Bible to the Jews. The Sunnah and the Hadith are always placed together in a compilation. So that thus the Sunnas, as I said, are biographical sketches of Muhammad's life written, again, centuries after his death. And each hadith is a narrative from the life of the Prophet and what he said. And so basically these two books describe what he said and he did. And many scholars believe that the Quran is really unintelligible without that expansion. Some believe that you need to understand these books to understand the Quran. And then there are different versions of these that are approved by most Muslims. And there's one collection by Sahih al-Bukhari, which is recognized as the overwhelming, by the overwhelming majority as being authoritative. By the way, the Hadith in the Quran also affirms the Jewish books of Moses called the Torah, that we call the Torah, and they call the Torah in Arabic. And they regard that too as a holy book. In addition to that, they acknowledge what we call the Psalms, the Zabur, as being another holy book. Moreover, they regard what we call the Gospels, what they call the Injil, as holy books. Now, at first blush, then, it would be rather good then to say that we can, let's build up from the Gospels and have them read the Gospels and see what they think about Isa, which is their word for Jesus. And while that can be a very effective tact, you have to bear in mind that Muslims declare that followers of Jesus have corrupted these shared books. It's very important for you to understand that. So anytime these books contradict what's in the Quran, by definition, the Quran is a correction of corruptions. You with me here? So it's a good system that works very well. Nevertheless, the Quran does teach Muslims that they should read these books. So I could actually tell a Muslim that, you know, your own holy book says that you should be reading the Injils, which are the Gospels, at least be aware of them. And if I can get a Muslim to buy into reading one of the Injils, I would have them right where I want them, because for the first time they'd be reading more directly about Isa or Jesus, and that wouldn't be a bad thing at all, would it? That'd be a great place for one to be. Nevertheless, I wanted to move on to another definition. Any comments or questions on what I've said so far, though, before I go any further? Make sure we're clear together on what we've been talking about. Anything needs to be clarified?
In terms of the authority of the Quran and the Hadith,
how do they... Yeah. The Quran and the Hadith are regarded as both being authoritative, but the Quran is really the true ultimate source, and the Hadith and the Sunnah supplement it effectively. So while they're all regarded as authoritative, the Quran is the top source. Because the Quran, unlike those books, is regarded, as we'll see later, as actually eternal. That the Quran is uncreated and always existed unchanged well before the time of Muhammad. Thus, it would trump the Hadith and the other traditional books and so forth that we would have. The Sunnah and the Hadith would be trumped because they're not eternal. So immediately that has an impact. Yes.
Is the Hadith primarily from the Medina? Quran is what God Gabriel brought him.
Yeah, the Quran's what Gabriel brought him, but remember, it was given to him over 22 years, and the early verses were in Mecca, the later surahs in Medina. So you had a part of them in one place, part in another.
And the Hadith?
And the Hadith then was later than all of that, several decades, actually more than a century, after Muhammad's death, that these were developed and then finally written out. So one could argue just logically that it's only the Quran that is actually an eternal book. You see where I'm going with that? So that would effectively trump it. And I'll talk about the implications that has a little bit later. Any other thoughts on this? Yes.
Why do you think it is that most Islamic countries still have sort of the theocratic rule with the Sharia law being very common, even like Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, there's been a movement. Why would the non-Shia, the Sunnis, still be largely moving towards Sharia? Because Sharia still, in spite of the idea that in some of these countries and some of among the Sunni, there should be a separation to some degree, there's been a trend, especially in recent years, toward the idea of bringing the world itself under Sharia, under Islamic law. So that trend is now affecting the Sunni as well. Although on average there would be a more of a militant approach to this in the Shia, but then you consider a Sunni sect like the Wahhabis, which are about as radical as you can get, and they're in Saudi Arabia, And so there they have a very, very strong vision, as does other groups like the Egyptian Brotherhood, I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood there. You hear about this in Egypt, and we all heard about that. And what's interesting about a group like that is their clear agenda is Sharia, though they say they're compatible with democracy. Once again, you have that principle of taqiyya. Remember that I said taqiyya? Where you can say what people want to hear so that we sound like we're pro-democratic. But what we do is we get the foot under the door, in the door, and then we can go to our true agenda, which is not just theoretical. It's very clear in where they are going. You've got to bear this in mind that essentially, and I'll develop this more in our time tonight, we're dealing with a territorial imperative here. You see, we're dealing really more than with a nation or with relationships. You're dealing with territory. You're dealing with the vision that the world cannot be at peace until it's all brought under the law of and the rule of Islam and subjection to that. So that just brings me to the next thing I want to talk about, Sharia. And what I want you to see is the Sharia is really, and not just Sharia, but Islam as a whole, you've got to see it as more than a religion. It's a complete package. It's a whole ideology, but it also makes prescribes requirements for civil law, for personal conduct, moral laws, political laws, as well as religious laws. So it's more of a whole ideology and not just a religion in this respect. And as I mentioned, Sharia is really a comprehensive body of Islamic laws that ought to regulate public and private aspects of the lives of Muslims. And it's not a single code, but rather it consists of different sources that legal experts appeal to. The first two especially are the Quran and the Sunnah, and there are other complementary sources that are used as well. But I would say, if you wanted to really get the essence, the teaching of the Quran, the Hadith, and then of the Sunnah are indeed the primary sources of this form of law. But there are other supplementary things called the consensus and the analogy that are also being used to provide more clarity for what that looks like. And like the idea of the merger of the church and the state, where especially in the Middle Ages, the Pope would reign effectively, technically supreme over the king. So also in Sharia law is the concept of the merger of mosque and state, and rather than the Pope controlling the king, however, the imam would control the ruler, just as it does in Iran today. So, for example, Iran's current imam, the Ayatollah Khamenei, not to be confused with Khomeini, who died several years ago, he's the supreme leader. He actually technically has a higher rank than the president of Iran. And so the Ayatollah is the highest ranking political, technically, and religious authority of the nation until his death, and then another Ayatollah will replace him. That's how that works in Iran. Now, the definition of Sharia is known as the way or the path, it's called. It's not democratic, it's not optional. Sharia is having been derived from the Quran, the Hadith, the Sunnah. It's not democratic at all. It's not optional. It's required that every Muslim carefully follow its laws. And this kind of Islamic absolutism is then a part of what incites cultural clashes with any kind of democratic political system. Sharia law actually specifies what are called had crimes, five of them. It includes unlawful sexual intercourse, both outside of marriage and adultery, false accusation of unlawful sexual intercourse, wine drinking, sometimes extended to include all alcoholic drinking, theft, and then also a highway robbery. And what's interesting is that punishments for these had offenses, H-A-D-D, would amount to flogging, stoning, amputation, exile, or execution. And sometimes these get significant media attention when they occur. Often they're done, especially, for example, in Saudi Arabia, they are done publicly, so that you have these exercises that are done publicly. One other definition I want to give you is that of an Islamic worldview. And this is an important and very radical distinction between two groups. There is, first of all, what is called the Dar al-Islam, which means the house of submission. And then its opposite. And Islamic scholarship divides the world then into the house of Islam, which means those nations who have submitted to Allah, and also the Dar al-Harb, which is the house of war. And that means that those are the nations who have not submitted yet to Islam. Even Wikipedia makes this statement, and I don't trust Wikipedia in a lot of areas, I have to tell you, but even they will make this pretty direct statement here, that in Islamic theology and legal interpretations, the ultimate aim of Islam is to bring the whole world under the dominion of Islam. Accordingly, each part of the world is given a descriptive status to delineate its current state in regard to the aims of Islam and to define the permissible conduct of Muslims in those regions. That's an interesting statement, that. It's in this context, then, that the world lived under that context in Muhammad's time and that it lives under today. And then as now, the fundamental message to the unbelieving world is the same, that one must submit to the house of Islam. And ultimately, that's true of an individual, but also of nations as a whole. So having spoken a little bit about the holy books, and they recognize several, as I've mentioned, but particularly the Quran, I want to use some quotes. I think it would be wise for us to find out directly from its own source what this book actually teaches. And it's very helpful for us to know, because few people are really given a clear portrait of what the Quran truly teaches. Now, in the year 610, when Muhammad was 40, we saw that he began to receive frightening revelations which were accompanied by violent seizures. And he wasn't sure whether these visions were divine or demonic. But his wife, Khadijah, encouraged him to submit to these revelations that were allegedly from the angel Gabriel. And he was told to recite these revelations. And it was his followers who recorded these oral traditions after his death and what became known as the Quran. And though 100 books, over 100 books are acknowledged, technically it's the Quran that's the final revelation, which consists of 114 surahs. A surah, S-U-R-A, is a chapter. And the length of the Quran is approximately 4/5 the length of the New Testament. And it was revealed over a period of 22 years. From that period of time then, from 610 and all the way up to Muhammad's death in 632. So it's a 22-year period of time. Again, the latter 10 years or so reflecting the Medina verses, and the earlier verses before he went up from Mecca. Now, this book is no easy read. How many of you have actually tried to read the Quran? A few of you have. It's not an easy read. In fact, it's similar to me when I had the experience of reading other books. For example, like the Book of Mormon and Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures and some of the books by the Jehovah's Witnesses. These are not, they're ponderous books. They're not really enjoyable reading at all. And what makes things even more difficult is that there's really has a complete lack of a thematic or logical or chronological order to it. It just bounces all over the map. And furthermore, the surah titles, although the chapters are given names, the titles are totally unrelated to the names of the chapters. One's called the cow. Well, there's no cow that's discussed here, so it's not entirely clear where all those came from. And it's interesting that the longest surahs were generally positioned toward the end of the book. So as a whole, though not all, as a whole, they tend to get longer and longer as they proceed. But here, too, there's a good deal of confusion and lack of organizations. In fact, sometimes the language seems to be crude and the arguments don't seem to be very, very clear at all. The claim, as I mentioned earlier, is that, yes, but it's a beautiful book when you read it in the Arabic. And it's an interesting claim because in my experience reading things like Dante or Tolstoy or Dostoevsky, I find it beautiful even in the translation. Yes, it's not as rich, but it's still, it comes through. But it doesn't come through in these translations. I'll let you try reading it. At any rate, you may remember that we talked about the concept of abrogation. I mentioned it again this evening. And this is the allowance that the Quran makes for Allah to retract and then to supersede certain verses. And we saw that the Medinan were more militant, the Meccan more peaceful. And about 86 of the surahs were largely peaceful, about 28 are militant, with some of them being composite. There are a few of them that have a little bit of both in them. And that covers, some of them have a kind of an overlap between the two different time periods of Mecca and Medina. Again, the order is not always that exact. The Meccan verses, as I mentioned already, tend to be shorter. The Medina surahs, those chapters tend to be longer. And of course, the Meccan were earlier, the Medinan later. And why is this distinction important? Because it's this very contrast that sets the stage for the polar opposite contradictions that exist then as to whether it's a religion of peace or not. So these, what do you do with these contradictory statements about the required behavior of a Muslim toward the infidel or the unbeliever, which means any non-believer, whether religious or not, non-believer in Islam? And Muslims who emphasize the Medinan surahs naturally obey their militant commands. And these, of course, would include people on that part of the spectrum. Osama bin Laden would certainly fit that understanding of the Quran. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad would certainly fit in that category, whereas Muslims who completely disagree with them would emphasize the more peaceful Meccan verses, including Queen Rania of Jordan and Dr. Malida Lodi, whom we mentioned before. We also alluded to Tony Blair, George Bush, and Barack Obama, all of whom say, no, it's a religion of peace. And there's a difference of emphasis there. Furthermore, those who emphasize the Medinan surahs tend to view the militant lifestyle of Muhammad and the militant commands as prescriptive, meaning that they are prescribing that behavior as a good Muslim, and one should imitate his life. Whereas the Muslims who emphasize the Meccan surahs regard these as examples and commands as merely descriptive, but not really prescriptive for us. So these are optional commands then, and from their point of view then are not required by good Muslims. And they may also consider, as we mentioned earlier, the militant commands in a figurative rather than a literal sense. Now the camp that holds to the Medina surahs tend to be those who take what I would regard to be what I call a consistent position. And what I mean by that word, again, is those who hold to the Meccan surahs tend to be, to the Medinan surahs, tend to take the Quran literally and in a consistent manner, rather than in the secular and moderates who tend to take it in a more figurative manner. Now, the debate could possibly be minimized to one of mere emphasis, except for two principles, and one is abrogation, and the other has to do with the eternality of the Quran. We mentioned abrogation, again, favoring the consistent militant camp, because these were the later surahs which supersede the earlier contradictory surahs, and so that the consistent Muslim will argue with complete justification that his theology of Islam is the true Islam, and that the secular or moderate position, really, these are people who take a stance of disobedience or ignorance to the Quran. So those who take the consistent position, such as those who are in the Wahhabi sect, will go so far as to say that secularists and moderates aren't even true Muslims, that in fact they too are infidels who may deserve to be killed. And that's why the Muslim suicide bombers often, we find out, are killing other Muslims and not just non-Muslims. There's a reason for that. So again, before we make one final point about the two contradictory interpretive viewpoints, this is the other thing I was alluding to earlier, this principle of Qadim. And you need to understand this. It means that the Quran has always existed in heaven, and as such, is uncreated and perfect. Very important principle, this. Because it's as important to understand this as it is the principle of abrogation to understand what the Quran is dealing with. Being eternal, being uncreated, and being perfect. So thus it existed before Muhammad was born in its form. It's without error, requires therefore, and could not have change. It cannot be amended. It cannot be corrected, even to the slightest degree. You see this concept? It's very important in its implications. It's perfect then as it is and as it was orally revealed, virtually dictated, as it were. And so this principle of Qadim has major implications today, because those who call for a reform of Islam, who are normally the secularists and the moderates, would have a problem with that, as I'm going to mention now. The stated perfection of the Quran, including its doctrines of Qadim and abrogation, means that there can be no picking and choosing of verses between the revelations that descended in Mecca and the revelation that came later in Medina. Why? Both are perfect. Both are eternal. You're tracking with me with this? Thus they both have complete authority. Thus Islam itself faces an intractable problem, and here's the problem. It's trapped in a closed circle. You see, if the Quran was uncreated and always existed in heaven, the peaceful Muslims cannot delete the consistent Medinan surahs and must obey them too. And the issue here is, how can you have these contradictions if it was perfect and always revealed? In other words, the law of abrogation seems to imply that one would, in fact, let the later ones trump the earlier ones, but then we find that through Qadim, they all existed. So you see the issue here? It's really an intractable logical problem. But the implications of this doctrine mean this, that the people like the Wahhabis would never make an attempt to reform Islam, because it wouldn't make any sense. And if the secularists and the moderates sought to reform it, make it truer to its roots or whatever, their only honest choice would be to follow Muhammad's allegedly perfect militant example, as well as obeying the militant Medina surahs with regard to those who are outside of the Dar al-Islam, those who are in the Dar al-Harb, the house of war. So to honestly reform Islam is to return it to its militant roots. It's not to reform Islam into a religion of peace without negating the Quran's alleged perfection and its doctrine of abrogation. So what I'm suggesting is that really it doesn't allow it for this to occur. One of the things we should also note is that one of the Quran's serious scholarship problems is its historical or factual errors. I have a whole teaching on this, which I won't go into, but this is just one illustration, Surah 930, which states, and the Jews, and again, this is straight from the actual the book that I don't think I mentioned, but I'll show you where I'm getting the quotes in a minute. Bottom line is, the Jews say Ezra is the son of Allah. Christians say no. Say the Messiah is the son of Allah. And these are the words of their mouth. And so it says they imitate the saying of those who disbelieved before, Allah's curse be on them, how they are turned away. And so what we have here is the second statement, that Messiah is the son of Allah. Well, that is true, what Christians do say that. But I don't know of any Jew who would say that Ezra is. No Jew ever said that, ever will. For them, it would be a very bizarre statement, completely erroneous from a Jewish perspective. And this is one of numerous blunders that call into question, again, the veracity of a book that claims to be eternal and perfect. And this, but I want to again go back to the Quran's claim to be a correction of the thousands of years of biblical history, and which it claims has been corrupted by the Jews and the Christians. So when evaluating the truthfulness of the ideology of Islam, you've got to determine this, whether the Quran itself is a proper correction to other religions, Christianity and Judaism, which predated it by centuries, indeed thousands of years with Judaism, or whether the Quran itself is a corruption of those texts and of those religions from whose doctrine the Quran then borrows and revises. So you've got to answer this question, is it a correction or is it a corruption? You don't have any other options. You with me? Because they do not agree. And so you have to make this decision. Naturally, the Muslim has to believe that it's a correction. Has to therefore believe it was corrupted, though there's no historical or textual evidence anywhere to support that idea of when was it then corrupted? When was the New Testament corrupted? Since we actually have, for example, in the New Testament, documents that date within a few decades of the original in some cases, and certainly within 100 years and 200 years, the entire New Testament, when did this corruption take place? But you have to believe that in order to buy that. Any questions on that, that concept? Because I'm about to move now to the quotes themselves. Few minutes for some quotes. Is that clear? I'm trying to build a clear case, fair case, objective case as well as I can. But I'm trying to be consistent and fair to what they actually teach and what their books teach. This is what I'm trying to do, rather than some external understanding. Given this, then, it's one thing to have someone tell us what the Quran says. It's another to read it firsthand. So let's go directly to the source and take a look at some of the quotations to see what it says about these matters of peacefulness or militancy with regard to non-Muslims. Now, all the quotations that we're going to see are going to be scanned out of this book, the Holy Quran, and it has both the English but also the Arabic text alongside of this English translation and with a commentary by Maulana Muhammad Ali. This was revised in 2002. So this is a book then that's regarded as authoritative. And it turns out that scholars have shown that about 150 jihad verses exist in the Quran. What I mean by jihad verses specifically relate to this issue of warfare or struggle, particularly in Surahs 2 through 9, those chapters, which are the later Medina chapters revealed to Muhammad. They're longer than the others. And this is why this Muslim militant is actually holding up the Quran in justification of his actions, precisely because he's submitting to the will of Allah as revealed, he believes, to the Prophet Muhammad. So let's take a look. So again, these are just scanned in from this particular book, from its text. Surah chapter 3, which is chapter 3, the third chapter of the Quran, which is Surah 3, verse 118, exhorts the faithful Muslims with this command, O you who believe, take not for intimate friends other than your own people. They spare no pains to cause you loss. They love that which distresses you. Vehement hatred has already appeared from out of their mouths, and that which their hearts conceal is greater still. And so this Quran command here is telling Muslims not to take non-Muslims as their close friends, because it's saying that they vehemently hate you, and that they'll even hide their deeper hatred for you. Now, we should ask ourselves whether this characterization of Muslims, non-Muslims rather, is in fact true or false. I mean, is it true of us personally, as a nation, as a global community? And regardless of our answer, it's plain that the Quran instructs Muslims not to befriend or assimilate into non-Muslim communities and characterizes non-Muslims as persecuting hate mongers. It also gives Muslims sufficient reason to distrust, if not hate non-Muslims, whom this verse claims to actually loves to hate them. So, of course, many Muslims would point to the Crusades, however, as a case in point of the truth of this verse, but then we have to ask whether the Crusades represent the attitude of all non-Muslims everywhere throughout all time, and as such is a fair and honest assessment, and that would be a very questionable claim. At any rate, that's one of those verses, and then the following verse, Lo, you are they who will love them while they love you not. And you believe in the book, in the whole of it. And when they meet you, they say, we believe. And when they are alone, they bite their fingertips and rage against you, say, die in your rage. Surely Allah is knower of what is in the hearts. So essentially here, the verse teaches this. Allah the knower claims to know what's in the non-Muslims' hearts. And thus it's actually the Muslims who are the ones who love the non-Muslims rather than the other way around. Additionally, Allah is claiming that non-Muslims bite their fingertips in rage against Muslims and therefore prescribes this approach, this response from Muslims, die in your rage. In other words, tell them to die in their rage. That's what it's effectively saying to do. So with teaching like this, it's not hard to see why Muslim demonstrations in the Middle East get pretty filled with anger toward non-Muslims. And it should be noted that Allah's claim of the love of the Muslims toward, for example, let's say the 800 beheaded Jews in Jerusalem under Muhammad, or Omar's attack on the non-Muslims in Jerusalem in 638 AD, whether that would be difficult for any of these victims to believe, not to mention also the issue of the thousands of attacks and jihadist acts in our own time in the last few decades. At any rate, the next surah teaches that the only punishment of those who wage war against Allah and His Messenger and strive to make mischief in the land is that they should be murdered or crucified, or their hands and their feet should be cut off on opposite sides, or they should be imprisoned. This shall be a disgrace for them in this world, and in the hereafter they shall have a grievous chastisement. Now here the Quran is prescribing murder, crucifixion, decapitation for the enemies of Islam. And it makes the claim that those who wage war against Muslims are to wage war against, that they are actually waging war against Allah, against Muhammad. And they're going to be punished, therefore, in the hereafter. Now this verse today, of course, directly applies to Christians and to Americans who have waged war in Islamic lands, not only during the Crusades, but also from in recent history. This is why many Muslims claim the United States' so-called war on terror amounts to an attack of Islam, and that they are therefore worthy of the wrath of Allah and those who submit to Allah. You can see how that would be interpreted in light of this kind of a text. Again, holding the Quran in their militant jihad. Now, yes, you could try to make this figurative. Tough to do, though. You know, it takes a few exegetical gymnastics to make this thing really not external at all, but just in a hard attitude. It really would be very strange. Going on to Surah 929, and with this we'll have to stop. It tells us, fight those who believe not in Allah, nor in the last day, nor forbid that which Allah and His Messenger have forbidden, nor follow the religion of truth out of those who have been given the book until they pay the tax in acknowledgement of superiority and they're in a state of subjection. And so the concept again is very clear. Muslims must fight non-Muslims, and remember again that the secularists and the moderates interpret this kind of militant verse figuratively, dismissing it as a wholly internal struggle rather than a literal physical fight. And those who take the consistent position, however, understand it in its very plain and obvious sense and obey it passionately. Note also that this verse is making the claim that Islam is exclusively the religion of truth and that those who do not believe and obey Allah don't follow the religion of truth. Further note that non-Muslims are to be put in a state of subjection to Muslims, to acknowledge the superiority of Muslims by paying a tax, as it says, of submission to them. It's a tax and acknowledgement of superiority. So again, this and others that we'll be looking at as we conclude our discussion in our next session are very critical texts. I do have time for a little bit. I could do some more of these verses, but I think I'll stop with them and instead just see what kind of closing questions you have, and I'll try to complete my thoughts in our next session together. Yes.
And so, sir, if you're not being claimed that non-Muslims are disingenuous and therefore not, and yet they have permission to be disingenuous.
Well, you have to bear this in mind that there's always been this double standard. So, for example, in the West, they will have a hue and a cry to anything that is perceived as being discriminatory against Islam. Am I correct? Is that correct? And yet, try starting a church in any Islam, in any country that's ruled by Sharia. See how well that goes. That'll go over real well. You would pay with your life in Saudi Arabia. My point here is that it's a totally incongruous approach. When it suits We want to be open-minded and fair, and there should be no discrimination, there should be tolerance. But when it doesn't suit our cause, and last time I checked, those Islamic states are not really favorable to any form of toleration at all. So you have two different sets of rules. It's basically, again, part of the ethos, the culture, that's driven by these principles in Sharia and their own culture, that very culture. Yeah. Yes.
We often hear that the Quran says to kill or hurt. Is that true?
Yes. We already saw one such verse that tells us to do that. It tells them to behead or to That's one of the verses. There are numerous others. You'll see some more next week. What do you think? You have to bear this out, and this is not proof texting. I invite you to read the context here. It's consistent, but there are over 150 such verses that at least talk about a form of jihad that on face value is very clearly more of a bellicose approach rather than just an internal struggle. So there are numerous such texts. Rarely are these heard, though, because it sounds intolerant. What we have, interestingly enough, and this is this is just parenthetical, but it's politically incorrect to criticize Islam in any manner. Perhaps you've noticed this, and yet when certain Muslims are appointed to be in positions in Homeland Security, they're called devout Muslims. But you'd never say, "Oh, he's a devout Jew or a devout Christian." That would be separation of church and state. You see what would happen? It's okay for them to be a devout Muslim, though. So what I'm saying is you have a lack of parity even in our own country, whereby it's open season to criticize, especially Christians, and to some degree Jews, but don't try that with Muslims or other groups. So once again, what you have here is a philosophy of correctness that actually plays perfectly into the hands of the desire of people to ultimately bring in Sharia through the back door quietly and in a bloodless manner. It plays right into their hands. And it's what I would regard to be a cultural naivete. And as I mentioned before, there's a growing awareness, although it's too late and too little, even in Europe, that the agenda of multiculturalism is death to the unity of a country. And at the end of the day, then, you can't play by those sets of rules. So what we have going on here, then, are dramatic processes that actually are playing right into the hands through the naivete of people and the failure to grasp what their own book teaches, their own traditions teach, their own prophet did, total ignorance of that, to where we have this cleansed version that's correct and tolerant. You see the concept? I'll have a word to say about one of my favorite bumper stickers, but we'll do it next week, coexist. And I have a comment about that bumper sticker that you'll see next week. We didn't have time to go into it. But again, in my view, it represents a remarkable degree of naivete. I often hear as well as people who will say, well, the more, if you really understood the religion, you'd know that they're all worshiping the same God and all this, and it doesn't teach that at all. And when people make that claim, it tells me how little they know about the religion itself, its own claims, its own holy book. Because you have to, if you want to have integrity, what does it actually claim? Don't say what you think it claims or what sounds that it should claim. What does it really claim? And that's where I believe that intellectual integrity is necessary. Yes?
Now, the Sharia law, you said it comes from all the books and the Quran. Is there a separate written out Sharia law?
There are different versions that are used, but there are certain sources, four fundamental sources that are used to work that out. But it's fairly complex and elaborate. But there are schools of thought within it, but there is one primary school that seems to be more dominant. But what we have to understand is this law encompasses not merely religious practices, but civil practices, moral practices, political engagement, a variety of things. As I said, thus it's more of an ideology, and it's not democratic.
And is there a governing body then that will oversee these laws being...
Well, again, that, for example, the imams would be those in, for example, in Iran who would seek to do that, and those who are in authority, the various Muslim authorities and leaders in other countries would then serve to put that together and create a body in that regard. But the thing I'm going to be stressing, again, as we conclude, is that it is a religion of peace. But you get to have to define what that means. Peace means this: when all the world is brought under Sharia, then there will be peace. And we're going to see that their own holy book claims that the Jews need to be destroyed in order for that to occur. Consequently, it's needful to kill off the Jews or you'll never have Sharia. They're the thorn in the flesh. You see, this is the interesting thing. And those who support the Jews are regarded as being infidels as well. Thus, the Satan and the great Satan. You know that imagery there. Yes. Yeah, you have various. Here's interesting. Within that, you have so many different sects, like the Wahhabi sect and so forth. That each one of them has their own particular structure and approach. And I mentioned each of them has, it's not monolithic. So even within the Sunnis, you have a whole lot of different sects who teach that, some more militant, some less, some much more Sharia-oriented, and then they get to define what that looks like. So there's not monolithic. But what we have to understand, though, there is still a basic understanding of what Sharia looks like, and then Sharia law courts, for example, that are being allowed in the UK, would then actually allow a different set of rules for people who are Muslims than for non-Muslims. Thus, a Muslim husband can beat his wife, whereas someone who's a non-Muslim would not be allowed to do so. You see, they can do a variety of things that are, in fact, not allowed by the law of the land if those things are done under Sharia law. And as you know, that there is going to be a growing movement in this country to bring that about, Sharia, and several states are even playing with that, Michigan being an obvious example. Once again, and it'll be done in the name of what? What's the word? What it'll be done under?
Tolerance.
What else? Multiculturalism. You see the idea? And as I said before, once you start playing that by that, you have an erosion. There's not an integrity. There is a loss of culture, and then what we have here are chaotic. And who gets to define what tolerance looks like? Yes.
Would you say that some of the charter schools, just right here in Atlanta, that they all choose what is going to be the foreign language, and there are several that have chosen Arabic as their foreign language?
Well, I think you can see all kinds of things that are leading in that direction. I mean, there's all kinds of things that we look around and see are growing. And we haven't even commented about the impact of the prison system and how the prisons are actually incubators of Islam. And many of the chaplains and so forth. And it's a fairly radical form of Islam that's actually being conveyed in prison. So we have incubators and so forth that are also going on. Thus, there really doesn't need to be a direct war. There are a lot of reasons why that when Europe, as we mentioned before, just the numbers, that just the demographics will bring that about. In the United States, there's a process that's playing right into the hands. And so this is what's going to happen. Let's close then. By the way, before I quit, this can be depressing, some of this. I understand that. But having said that, you need to grasp that the biblical perspective is one of the sovereign purposes of God, and that God raises up kings and he deposes kings. Daniel makes it very clear that God is sovereign. And he's actually going to use even the orchestrations of men and their machinations and their malevolent intentions or whatever that looks like. God is bigger than those things. And he can turn it to a higher good. It's not that he's making them do that, but he is able to use what is being done for good. Because the scriptures teach that actually pain and suffering and adversity and a lot of these kinds of things in the larger scheme of God is going to be redemptive. That God's going to accomplish his purposes through that. And that he's not surprised when this happens or that happens. One can do a thought experiment. There were several attempts on Muhammad's life in Mecca. Suppose one of them had succeeded. How would the world be different? Well, by nature, that would require middle knowledge, and no one knows. But it's an interesting thought experiment how radically things would be different. One could then say, didn't God have foreknowledge and know that this was going to come to pass? You see where I'm going with this. That God is, in fact, sovereign over history, rules over it, but he also uses all things, even the wrath of men, the Psalms say, will praise him. And so my view about the matter is understanding, actually, that we live in very exciting times when we're beginning to see a wide variety of processes that the Scriptures predicted coming to pass. So frankly, it's actually quite extraordinary. I think these are extraordinary times where we're seeing processes that were predicted now being fulfilled before our very eyes. One document I'd refer you to that I have on my website, kenboa.org, go to text resources and type in unprecedented evidences. Just type that in for the end times. You got that document, didn't you? I have a list of, I think it's 18 unprecedented evidences of things that have occurred in the last 60 years that have never occurred before and that are all actually consistent with the biblical vision of that time. And so it's actually a rebuttal to the argument, oh, people have always said that Jesus is coming back soon. The answer is that these are phenomena and processes that have never before occurred until basically our own generations. And so it's really quite a time to live. And by the way, the process of that fulfillment is accelerating. People have trouble thinking in a non-linear term. We're talking about exponential, not linear, and various processes are moving us in that direction. So do not despair. God's on the throne, and all will be well, and all will be well, and all manner of things will be well. Let me close with a prayer. Father, we thank you that you have given us the revelation that tells us about the ways in which your purposes will be fulfilled and that Messiah will return, and that ultimately your kingdom will then rule and reign, and you will reside over all the nations of the world. Those empires will go, but yours will endure. And we thank you, Lord, that you have called us to be your children, people who can know you and love you and follow you. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this talk, which is part of a series of messages by Dr. Ken Boa. To order additional talks on CD or MP3, or to learn about any of Dr. Boa's other Bible-based teachings, go to our web ministry at kenboa.org. That's kenboa.org. Or call 1-800-DRAW-NEAR. That's 1-800-372-9632.